Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
From Variety, celebrating more than 115 years covering the business of entertainment, this is the Award Circuit Podcast.
I think what we lacked in money, we showed up with heart and soul. That we had excess of that. I think that's what, that's the only way you can explain how we make certain shots every day. There's some shots that, normally you'd need a horse wrangler, you'd need a first AD, you'd need a couple PAs, you'd need to make so many of these different shots happen that just, somehow magically came together.
With a minimal budget and a small amount of time, Clifton Collins Jr. brings life and beauty to his performance as a horse racer, feeling the effects of decades on the equestrian circuit and Sony Pictures Classics Jockey. I'm Clayton Davis. On this episode of the Variety Award Circuit Podcast, we talk to Clifton Collins Jr. about taking on the role of Jackson Silva in Clint Bentley's directorial feature debut. But first, our Award Circuit panel discusses the latest regarding the tragic death of cinematographer Helena Hutchins on the New Mexico set of the independent film Rust. We also run down Variety's 10 Actors to Watch ceremony and new releases, including Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho. It's all on this edition of the Variety Award Circuit Podcast. Stay close.
Hi, everyone. It's the Award Circuit Roundtable. Michael Schneider back with you, along, as always, with Clayton Davis, Jazz Tanke, and Janelle Riley. And want to kick off things this week. Obviously, the big news that we're all still discussing, and I think are going to be discussing for a long time to come, is obviously the tragedy on the set of Rust in New Mexico. It's something that we've all been covering the past several days now and discussing. New information is constantly coming out. So at the risk of new details coming out, after we record this and after this podcast airs, nonetheless, we're starting to get a real picture of some real negligence on the set that's sort of indicative of some ongoing issues just overall in filmmaking. Jazz, I want to start with you, since obviously so much of this conversation deals with artisans, craft folks, and really what happened and didn't happen on that set. So from your perspective, what's sort of the latest that you're hearing and understanding from what went on down there?
I guess I'm a few hours behind because, as you're, Clayton and I actually at the Savannah Film Festival, but I spoke to Stephen Lighthill, who's the president of the ASC, and trying to get his gauge on, what is going on. And I think at the end of the day, he said, it wasn't a prop gun. They used a real gun. There was a breakdown of protocols. And I think that is the main thing. There are protocols in place. None were followed. There's also the bigger story of, the below the line crew members who had previously been talking about COVID protocols not being in place, gun safety protocols not being in place, and also working long hours. So, I feel like that is definitely going to be in the spotlight, especially as we just, the IATSE strike vote or the ratification of that is in the ether. It's in the conversation. So I think that that's where we are right now.
Yeah, and this could really have an impact on an agreement that already was unpopular with IATSE members. You already see cars around town before this tragedy, folks saying vote no, people really disappointed with how things turned out. I think this just obviously amplifies that. Clayton, you and Jazz, like Jazz mentioned, you're both down there in Savannah right now. Are folks talking about this? What's the sense you're getting from just people in the industry as you run into them on the circuit?
Yeah, so because we're on the ground at the Savannah Film Festival, it's a very big production school, and there's a lot of people that work in TV and film production that are here. I actually moderated a panel, did a masterclass today with students, and it came up. There were several questions about it. What I shared today, you know, and why, you know, Helena's death is so tragic. And again, it's breakdown of protocol, but this is the core of what Ayati was fighting for safety, you know, across the board. And what we're seeing now, and listen, we don't know what we don't know in terms of where we go from here, but for the first time, I feel like the guilds are going to have some power in determining, you know, what this looks like moving forward. I think that the general consensus is, you know, we asked for a lot of things that we didn't get that, you know, were unpopular. And then Helena's tragedy happens. And then now, you know, how are you, Hollywood studios, going to combat and say no to these requests that are just, you know, bare minimum with safety and just so you can be safe going to work? I think Hollywood could be at a crossroads in terms of, you know, either they're showing that every worker is supported, or is it really just about the bottom line? And I don't know, the court of public opinion is going to be greater than any dollar amount that they'll need to spend on just making sure that everyone's safe and everyone's doing the correct things across the board.
Well, and Janelle, you know, I know you have a lot of friends in this industry. I'm sure you've talked to folks as well. One of the things that struck me in attending the candlelight vigil the other night for Helena Hutchins was the number of people who said this could have happened to any of us. This is, you know, indicative of a larger issue of just, you know, crew members, people who work on these productions, who, you know, continue to, you know, work these long hours. Safety is just not, you know, at the forefront. And, you know, obviously this isn't the first example of people dying on sets or getting super injured on sets because of the overworked nature of production.
I don't know how people work those hours. I really don't. And I just came from the Newport Beach Film Festival where Jeffrey Wright received an award from us. And one of the things he made sure to say in his speeches was, they deserve everything they're asking for and more when talking about his crew. You know, these are the first people who show up, the last people to leave. They work so hard. Everyone will acknowledge that. You literally can't do it without them. And I just don't know why it's necessary to work these crazy hours. Like, I mean, I'm assuming it all comes down to money, but there's something to be said for, you know, quality of you know, being on the job. I just think there need to be some major changes. And I apologize. I was told that her name was pronounced Galina.
No, I spoke to her best friend who said it was Helena.
It is Helena. Okay. That was...
It's Helena.
Helena.
Helena. Helena.
Helena. Yeah. Okay. Helena Hutchins. Yeah, I mean, it is such a small world, so it was interesting to see how many people I knew who had worked with her and who just talked about, you know, her love for this craft and, you know, what a fascinating eye she had. And it's just, you know, it's just a tragedy on so many levels.
Yeah. Yeah. And she had such a great backstory. I mean, she's an immigrant from the former Soviet Union and worked her way up to, you know, this preeminent role as a cinematographer, seemed beloved by, you know, other crew members, by faculty at AFI, where she studied. She mentored new generations of young, aspiring directors of photography and cinematographers. And, you know, it just sounded like, you know, a real, you know, passionate, someone who just loved film, who really wanted to work in this business and managed to achieve some of those dreams. Had a family, had a son, had a husband. It's just tragic all around.
Yeah, I just want to add something that I just remembered that one of the students that was speaking today, that was in the masterclass with me today, that has worked on a few TV shows that are filmed around here, says that what we've seen is the streamers, you know, these new players that have come into the space, you know, they're definitely employing a lot of people. And there's just big growth in how much money they're making versus, you know, anyone that ever was, you know, making movies and TV shows back in the day. But as they are making more money, these workers are not, you know, they're not being, you know, on top of safety, you know, Los Angeles, spoiler alert, is a very expensive place to live. And, you know, it's been, I can't imagine working. I can't imagine like $35,000, like some making like $35,000 a year.
No, I don't think like, and that's part of the issue with all the different guilds is the fact that, you know, they're, you know, the base pay is still so low given the cost of living here and in New York.
And I think just to wrap up, like, you know, as we are revisiting so many past occurrences on sets, you know, when this happened, like, you know, we went back to look at Brandon Lee. We went back, you know, Vic Morrow, like, you know, all these like big events looking back. And it's like, what has really changed? You know, is it just for face? And I think no matter what, I think everyone's aware of it now. You know, while social media is a terrible place, typically, I'm grateful that it's here because that word spread fast of what happened to her. And there, I don't think people are going to let up to take anything less than the things that are being asked for. And I think that's the best thing we can have.
I think just one more thing. And then, you know, it really makes the case stronger for working hours. So many of these crew members were tired, which is why they walked out the day before the tragedy happened. You know, so I feel it's like, come on, give them the weekend off, give them a longer turnaround. You have so much content. So what if you have to shoot an extra day just to accommodate that extra hour? I think that's the plea. That's what they want. And I also, you know, mental health. I really hope the crew members and Alec Baldwin too are getting their mental health support.
Well, there are two different things going on here because obviously we're discussing the issues that IATSE is raising and the issues of overworked crews, underpaid crews, et cetera. But then there is also the issue of firearms on set and the debate over whether or not there should be firearms on set. And
didn't the rookie announce that they banned firearms on set? Yeah, I think it was like the first show that did it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's going to be a bit of a tougher debate on, you know, what should be done, because there is an argument that, you know, this was a negligent individual. It sounds like, you know, from everything that we've heard, the first AD, it really came down to choices that he made that led to this tragedy. But also there's that debate over, you know, if used safely, properly, if you have a well-trained armorer on set, then nothing like this should ever happen. There's conflicting reports on what happened with this gun from, you know, what's been out there. Some people are saying that some of the crew members actually took these guns and used them as target practice over the weekend before. And so there's potential of live ammunition being trapped in these guns that led to this tragedy. You know, we haven't confirmed all of that yet, but that's a separate issue. And, you know, I've talked to quite a few armorers the past couple of days for stories. And, you know, they're not ready to suggest that we should get rid of firearms, that you know, as long as you're using proper techniques and you're properly handling these firearms, that there isn't live ammunition except for in the most unusual of cases, then something like this should never happen. Their argument is that there's still a realism to using, you know, real prop guns, which are basically real guns, for that realistic look in film. That's going to be a debate that's, I think, even inside the industry is going to be a little more contentious. You saw, I think, you know, folks are now trying to introduce bills in the California Senate, for example, to ban all firearms from sets. That's going to be a little more contentious. That's going to be interesting to see where things go from there.
Let's just cross our fingers, right?
Well, meanwhile, let's discuss some of the other things going on. Obviously, we mentioned Clayton and Jazz. You guys are in Savannah right now for the film festival there. Janelle, you were just in Newport Beach and you know, celebrated the 10 actors to watch through Variety. Tell us a little bit about that. And
oh, such a fun event. I look forward to it every year, largely because at the Balboa Bay Resort, where we held this event with the Newport Beach Film Festival, they have the most amazing shrimp you've ever had in your life. I kept raving about it. And you think I'm joking?
Look, 10 shrimp to watch.
you think I'm joking, but like Simon Rex talked about the shrimp. There was the shrimp was on everyone's, it was the buzz of the festival. No, but it was a great event. You know, we had some of our 10 actors to watch. Moses Ingram kind of brought the house down by telling a story about how she had a terrible audition and she tried to hide in the trunk of her car. I guess just out of embarrassment for what a bad audition it was. And she just kept laughing as she was telling the story. And everybody was like, did she say what I think she said? Filippo Scotti from The Hand of God was there. And he also got to introduce his film, which got a really nice response. We had
the official submission now, by the way, for Italy.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, was there any doubt?
Ikiara was put up a fight, but yes, yeah. It felt pretty preordained.
Justin H. Min was there, who everyone fell in love with, and Sanaa Sidney, who the world is beginning to fall in love with, who plays Venus Williams in King Richard. Just there were several times, I hate to belabor this fact, but there were several times I had to say, are you sure you're 14? Because she would say the most insightful, interesting, grounded things. You know, and I just, I know I say it every week. I can't wait for the world to see that movie. We also, as I mentioned earlier, gave our Legend and Groundbreaker Award to Jeffrey Wright. And then there were other honorees at the festival honored. Ray Liotta, who gave the shortest speech I think I've ever seen at one of these things. He was just like, I'm really grateful, but like, I'm not a good speaker. Harvey Keitel was hilarious. Regina Hall and Simon Rex were both receiving awards. So it was a Scary Movie 3 reunion. Yeah, Roseanne Arquette gave a great speech, and Thomasin McKenzie, soon to be seen this week in Last Night in Soho.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I was trying to provide Clayton a little segue there because I have to jump off and do something, but I know Last Night in Soho is opening this week. I don't know if you caught my clever little handoff there.
There we go.
Thanks for the handoff, Janelle. Have a great day.
I'm studying the Michael Schneider School of Segways.
All right, Janelle, do your
thing.
Thanks,
everyone. So sorry.
Clayton, grab that segue and run with it.
Yeah, Janelle's the worst. So, Last Night in Soho opens in theaters this week. Edgar Wright's new film. It is Edgar Wright loves movies. That is the best thing about him, and you see it in every film that he makes with Scott Pilgrim versus the World, now with Last Night in Soho with Thomasin McKenzie. It is a different type of movie, good mystery thriller. It was a bit divisive when it premiered at the festivals, but it's a good movie for the big screens. It could be a very strong craft player in a few spots, like production design, costumes, maybe even sound. But it's fun. It's if you like Edgar Wright, this is not a good. It's not a bad place to find yourself this weekend.
I have not seen it, but I have heard things about The Crafts and the soundtrack. Like, Edgar Wright just can do no wrong with his soundtracks, thinking of Baby Driver and now this.
Yeah, it's good to see him there doing it. And the other thing that opens this week is that of note is the Souvenir Part 2, now Gotham Award nominee, Souvenir Part 2. Which actually gives us the segue now to the Gotham Awards. That was the big thing of the week, which now we are in this genderless world with the Gotham Awards, which when you're the Gothams and you're a small group of five people that are, you know, deciding these nominees, I think it's okay to be genderless here. Because you don't run, there's not a high risk of, you know, 10 white guys, you know, being in the running. I think someone will sound the alarm if that's what's happening. But the big surprise was that you have up to 10 nominees. So they did 10 leads and then 7 supporting. The big surprise there was Reed Birney of the film Mass, was the only representation for Mass, and they seemed to ignore Martha Plimpton, Jason Isaacs, and who was thought to be one of the Oscar frontrunners, Ann Dowd. We don't know this for sure. Mark Harris was on that jury, and he tweeted out some thoughts on that. It reads as if maybe, don't know for sure, that I think there was a debate about them being all leads. Because it's interesting that we have seven supporting, and those are the three that are missing. So I think they just went with Reed Birney. Maybe he felt the most supporting of the four, which I think they're all in the same category. And I think you can argue that they are four leads, but that was the big kind of shocker of the morning. But Lost Daughter and Passing led. Lost Daughter is doing very, very well right now. Maggie Gyllenhaal's movie, who was our guest last week. And Rebecca Hall's Passing is doing very well with a great nomination for Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga, who I moderated a conversation with Ruth Negga last night and is delightful.
And Simon Rex got nominated too. I mean, I remember calling you when Mass got snubbed, but Simon Rex, Red Rocket, could he be a surprise sneak in? Or
I don't like people raising my hopes, so stop it. Keep telling me, let me be disappointed all season and then surprise me later. But I hope so. He deserves it.
I was happy to see Joaquin Phoenix in there. I know you and I love Come On, Come On. And just to see that film get recognized. And Pig, Nicolas Cage shows up.
Only nomination for Pig in Best Feature, but not Nicolas Cage, which was strange. But TV side had its fair share of stuff. So let's talk about that Squid Game, Mike.
Squid Game, it's starting. You know, Netflix, they think they've got a real player on their hands. They're expecting to maybe break through SAG, which I think would be the big news there. The first non-English international show to enter the cast race. So they're going to be pushing that hard, and this is they're off to a nice start. I was also happy to see some love for The Good Lord Bird, since the Emmys just decided to snub for whatever reason. Underground Railroad, which we've talked a lot about how that show just sort of, it didn't get the kind of the due that it deserved, partly because of when it launched, etc. White Lotus in the mix.
Starting the White Lotus train.
Starting the White Lotus train. And then, on the Breakthrough Series side, some love for Reservation Dogs, which I am really digging. I'm glad to see that show, small little comedy on FX on Hulu, starting to get, it's some attention. We Are Lady Parts as well on Peacock, another sort of show that, hopefully is going to get more recognition and more attention in the coming months. So pretty good mix.
I'm starting to get that bubbly feeling, which I probably shouldn't this early because the Emmys are a year away, but Reservation Dogs, Dark Horse, comedy series nominee for next year.
I could absolutely see it as sort of the it's very the What We Do in the Shadows.
Yes, it's very good comparison.
So if you haven't seen Reservation Dogs, seek it out because it's worth your time and it's really good.
And then performance in a new series, Jennifer Coolidge starts now. I was very surprised by the Queen's Gambit. Because that just, I thought we were done with it. I guess not. We still have one more award show with it.
Yeah, just the weird calendar situation of it. Omar Sy and Lupin. That's another, we're getting international here. Look at you got the awards. So.
And then it got some more Squid Game there. So when it opens up, when it opens up to membership, it's going to be interesting to see how they vote. It's going to be a fun little thing.
Yeah.
And Tuso, thank you, Gothams, for correcting the Emmys dark mark this year.
Exactly. So this begins an interesting, it's always TV award season, right? We never take a break.
Always. So. It's always award season, period.
Yeah, so true.
But yeah, that's it. And then the last thing to wrap up is that this week, my column focused on Clifton Collins Jr. in Jockey. This is the 10-year anniversary of Damien Bashir's nomination for A Better Life. Damien Bashir was the fourth Latino ever nominated for lead actor, one of two that's still alive. And Clifton Collins Jr. would be the fifth. So lead actors getting stacked, it's competitive, you see what happens. But at Middleburg, where I was with Jazz last week, I saw many films, but only two films I was at got got standing ovations. One was Belfast, the front runner for Best Picture. The other was Jockey, which leads me to believe if Clifton doesn't make it, it's because not enough people saw it. People have to give it its moment. If they watch it, I think he's in.
Clifton's on this week's episode, correct?
Clifton is this week's episode.
All right, well, we'll go to that right now. Thanks, Clayton and Jazz, and also Janelle somewhere out there.
And Janelle's memory.
See you guys next week.
After the break, Clifton Collins Jr., star of the new feature, Jockey. From Los Angeles, this is Variety's Award Circuit Podcast.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we're back. It's the Award Circuit Podcast, and I'm Clayton Davis. Clifton Collins Jr. has run the gamut in Hollywood. He's worked with actors such as Philip Seymour Hoffman in Capote, Robert Redford in The Last Castle, and Benicio del Toro in Traffic. He's also worked with directors like Alejandro González Iñárritu in Babel, Quentin Tarantino in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and J.J. Abrams in Star Trek. Now, he brings life and beauty to his performance as a horse racer, feeling the effects of decades on the equestrian circuit in Sony Pictures Classics' Jockey from director Clint Bentley. Collins Jr. is receiving critical acclaim for his turn, and if he is nominated for Best Actor, he will become just the fifth Latino to ever be recognized in the category, following Jose Fered, Anthony Quinn, Edward James Olmos, and Damien Bashir. I spoke with Collins Jr. about Jockey and also what we can expect from Guillermo del Toro's Nightmare Alley, in which Collins Jr. co-stars along with Bradley Cooper, Rooney Mara, and Cate Blanchett. He also opens up about the legacy of his grandfather, Pedro González González, a classic character actor who appeared in many John Wayne films over his career. We also discuss his work with Father Greg Boyle's Homeboy Industries. We began by talking about how much he identifies with Jockey's character.
Yeah, all of it. I didn't feel like Jackson while creating Jackson, but after the fact, I don't know, I think you maybe pay more attention to things after you've hyper-focused on them to create a character, and they just kind of linger with you.
You think you take a little bit of every character you play with you, like after it's
over?
Oh,
without a doubt.
Yeah.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, some more than others, depending on how deep the dive is. But obviously, when you don't have any money, all you can do is dive deep.
I'm waiting for you to take over the world, man, from Star Trek, man. You have that.
It's happening.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to say, but today I've announced officially it is happening.
For a lot of our, you've been a great character actor for such a long time, just having so many roles in so many movies that people forget that you're in so much over the time. I would love for you to talk about your grandfather, because Pedro González González.
Yes, sir.
And for the people to know who he is and why you guys have that connection.
Well, the connection's because he's my grandpa.
Well, more so, I mean, connection to like your acting ability and
sure
inspiration.
Gosh, I mean, grandpa's. I think I'm like a fifth or sixth generation entertainer. My grandfather was mentored by some great comedians from the Texas vaudevillian circuit. So they're the guys that taught him, and he started when he was six, and then slowly made the transition at a radio station in San Antonio called WOAI. And from 1935 to 45, it was predominantly radio. That was entertainment. You sat by the radio. So he helped that radio station make the transition to television, which led to a telethon for cerebral palsy, emceed by Walter O'Keefe. And he had a game show at the time called Double or Nothing. He was really good friends with Groucho Marx, so he does the Double or Nothing show, thinks he's hilarious, calls Groucho Marx. Groucho Marx thinks he's hilarious. He's a big hit on this one episode. And all this fan mail floods NBC. And then John Wayne saw him and hired him to be a contract player, which for, you know, a little Mexican-American dude, you know, he can't read because he's been entertaining since he was six. Mm-hmm. He was very hesitant and a bit, he was very happy. He'd grown comfortable having a steady job at WOAI. And he had a band there that he could constantly either play with or do comedy with or improvise. Because so much of what he did, not only was he creating shows every week on this theater when he was doing the theater circuit in Texas, you know, he was writing them. So it, not handwriting them because he couldn't write, but he would write them in his head and he would dictate them to somebody. Or if he needed to come in, he could improvise as well. He was that kind of a song and dance man. And he always had gigs. Like, he knew he could drop a song or a dance, or he had a whole litany of a set list of entertainment. Variety show, like vaudeville is.
Did you always know your entire life that you were going to be an actor?
I did not, but I was always a class clown, so I think that I think subconsciously, yes.
You knew you were going to perform. It was in what?
I did, and you know, I think my first stage was probably, well, earlier on when my cousin and I would be tap dancing, because we started around seven. You know, it was grueling. Like they gave us the vaudevillian schedule of practice. They hated us at the talent shows at school because we would show up with like top hats and canes and suits, and kids have like paper costumes with markers. You know, we had Arthur Duncan from the Lawrence Welk show come in and choreograph a dance and song for us. I mean, it's full blown, like, nobody's going to touch us. Whenever we'd show up, my sister too, because my sister and them, they did. Who's a casting director now? She's why I was able to do Star Trek, because J.J. Abrams was doing Alias, and she was casting Alias. But she had married the dude in 187, Jonah Rooney, so her name became Veronica Rooney. So when he had modeled this character after Frankie Flowers in Traffic, and just had the crazy idea, like, God, would this guy even do it? Does he even do television? And I was such a snooty, like, I've got to be a struggling, independent film actor. I've got to, like, barely make rent this month. I got to feel real. I can't do television. My sister was like, I know you don't do TV, but this is J.J. Abrams. He's a family man. He's a good-hearted person. He's going to be an insane filmmaker. You got to do this. He wrote this for you. I'm like, sis, look, I'm not doing it. What's too bad? I already told him you're doing it, so you're doing it. I was like, what?
Is she little sister or older sister?
2 to 3 years younger than me.
And she you just let her strong arm you like that,
she,
man?
She already committed me.
She was just like...
But she's always been like the voice of reason. She's always been like the moral core, like the family, so to speak. My grandfather knew that when she was a young girl. Like, he nicknamed her the queen and shit when she was like three. She was destined.
So we know who's in charge over there. That's right.
Pretty much. Right. I was like, fine, I'll do it.
Getting your start and working with, you mentioned Traffic, working with Steven Soderbergh, you worked with, Robert Redford on The Last Castle, and then, you know, the big film that many of us will revere you for, I always feel is your gift to cinema thus far, is Perry Smith in Capote.
Thank you.
And Bette Midler's first movie.
Yeah, first feature.
Going from, you know, Soderbergh won the Oscar, Redford, who had won an Oscar before, and then you go to a first-time director like Bette Midler. Was it a transition for you, or you were? Was it all about the work that's there and work with Philip?
It's all about the work too, but also you got to remember the Philip, Dan Futterman, the writer, and Bennett, they'd all been friends since they were like 14, 15, 16 years old, and they're all from New York. So it's very much that parallel, you know, Perry Smith with The Outsider. Here I am, Clifton Collins from L.A., the L.A. street actor. And these guys are all theater and trained and from, you know, the school of acting. So they had this whole thing. So there is very much like the book as well in that respect. And Bennett was very meticulous in the rehearsal spaces, which I was really grateful for. He did say that we would never do certain, the big reveal scene at the end. He said, we'll never get to that place. And I said, well, why is that? He said, I want to save it for the camera. I said, well, I'm I mean, we can rehearse as much as you want to. And we can do it as many times in front of the camera or off. He's like, no, we're going to save it. And then one day during rehearsal, I think they just wanted to test it out. And I totally saw them going there in my head as the moments were getting longer and longer in this scene. And we're getting to that place they said we were never going to get to. And boy, I think he just wanted to see what was under the hood. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the direction changed a little bit from that point. Because I think it was questioned one of the ads is like, you're a big softy, he said. I was like, oh, I thought we were in a safe place. I thought this was a rehearsal. But okay, so what's the next scene? Let's do it. Yeah.
what do you remember most fondly about Phil and working with Philip Rothman?
Just how dedicated he was, how committed he was, how... you know, there's a degree of selfishness that I think every great artist has to have. You don't create art by just not being present with it. And it meant the world to Philip. You know, and by his own admittance, I think, I don't know, at that point in time, I remember him and I talking, and he said something like, Clifton, this isn't fun for me. This isn't fun. What's fun for me is hanging out at the coffee shop with my friends, smoking cigarettes, and drinking coffee. And I was like, whoa, dude. That means you got a job. Because I really love what I do. So I could do this for hours and hours and hours. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's painful. And he had the weight of the world on his shoulders is what I realized. So it kind of, because he was really concerned about not coming off the right way, it brought a bit of angst, and I think it robbed him a lot of the joys of it. Albeit, you know, when it came festival time, that was such a beautiful celebratory moment. I remember crashing the Golden Globes because I didn't have a ticket, and I decided to crash it at the end of the show because I felt it was safer and I had more opportunity to sneak in. And the first person to break through the doors was Philip. And that's when he had won. And it was, I just remember it so vividly because I was by myself. I was coming up on the side right off of Santa Monica Boulevard. And he came running out. And he's like, Clifton, I won. And he just gave me a big hug. And I could feel his heartbeat just racing, just from like the nerves and the anxiety. And really special.
That's cool. Awesome.
Yeah.
Now, to go into the reason why we're together here, you have a movie, Jockey, premiered at Sundance in January 5th. Time is relative. I don't remember when. It was earlier this year. And then it's been playing the festival circuit, and we're at Middleburg right now, where it screened. And I've been to a few of the screenings here, maybe one of two thus far that got a standing ovation afterwards. So I just want to say, man, it's looking good for you, and I love the movie. Tell us about the movie. Tell us about, obviously, the unlimited dollars of resources that you receive for independent cinema, right? Because you had every money that you could use for this movie, right? Yeah, everything.
I think what we lacked in money, we showed up with heart and soul. Yeah. That we had excess of that. I think that's what, that's the only way you can explain, how we make certain shots every day. Like, there's some shots that, you know, normally you'd need a horse wrangler, you'd need a first AD, you'd need a couple PAs, you'd need to make so many of these different shots happen that just, you know, somehow magically came together.
How many people are on set?
We had a crew of 10. Crew of 10, with the ambition of, 1,000.
And you, I mean, you guys didn't even have a script supervisor, right? Was he on set?
No script supervisor, no first AD, no second AD, no hair, no makeup, no lights, no trailers. Yeah, I had a pen to do rewrites.
did this differ from working on other? I mean, was this one of the smallest budgets that you've worked on for a while?
It has. I think the last time I worked on something this small might have been Jacob Vargas's Road Dogs, which we shot for $125,000. And we had gang members doing security for us. They would lock up all the ice cream trucks in a straight row.
Really?
They had walkie-talkies.
They're just talking.
We taught the gangbangers how to use them. and they were the best security. And then different neighborhoods, you had to use different gangbangers because they were rivals. But Jockey, it was a very small crew.
Yeah.
And we shot it in 20 days.
And preparing for the role, I mean, because you don't have that budget, I mean, what did you do to prepare for yourself personally? Because it's a great, outstanding performance, man. For me.
Thank you, man. When you have something that you really care about like that and you know you don't have money and the director and the producers, dear friends, you guys are like boys, it's like you're just showing up. It's like, you know, it's like you get into a fight after school at 3 o'clock. Like, I got you. You know, you just show up. So, and when you find out you lose money or you lost part of your budget before shooting, you just get more committed. Like, I love, I don't know why, being that salmon swimming upstream. Hey, that water's going to be extra heavy today. Awesome. I can't wait to get in there. It's going to be extra hard. Or, hey, you know, I want to learn how to play Bo Carter's I Get the Blues. That's one of the hardest songs to learn out the gate. Great. I can't wait to get started. You know what I mean? I don't know why. That just, it turns me on as an artist.
And listen, we were during the Q&A here at the festival, an audience member asked a very, very important question I always love to highlight here. You know, you're a Latino, you're in a leading role, and it's not the crutch of the movie is being a Latino in a leading role. You know, the movie starts off, I think, with Sin Buenas, and then it just, like, continues on. Like, it's just a part of it, which is what people like myself are asking for. When we talk about representation in the industry, we want Latinos in roles. We love Latino stories, and they're great.
Sure.
They're very important.
But don't everybody live the American me.
Yeah, like, it's not all about
some
that.
Some people are cowboys.
Yeah.
Some people are rodeo riders. And it's funny. And I've always got to decide, too. It's really about, you know, it's like I would talk to my grandpa. I said, you know, he'd be like, I said, sure, I'm sure I'm Mexican American. Yes, I was born here. He'd be like, but I'm a Texan. You soy Tejano. I was like, okay, Grandpa. You know, and it's funny, and addressing some of these characters from those areas when they're Latino, I got to be like, well, how, what's the culture that they reside in? Is it hardcore rodeo? Is it old world? Is it new world? Because if they're, you know, second, third generation, I mean, you could put a Klan hat on them and they could talk and you wouldn't know they were Latino because their accent's so damn country and thick. You know, and I think it's beautiful. I think that's real life. And so much of the horse racing community now is heavily Latino. You know, that's been a change over the last couple of decades. Yeah. You know, some, as you can tell in the film, some are like, you know, just off the boat, and others are not. You know, others are like, there's some Latinos in there that look white and that sound country. They're straight up. I'm like, in between takes, I'm talking Spanish to them just because we can. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's cool when you see a bunch of dudes that look like they're all white, suddenly so start speaking Spanish.
Yeah, throws you off, right?
Throws the other people, not us.
This is, I mean, you've had leading roles before, but this is maybe like your largest, most significant that people are going to, like, you know, we're going to try to get as many people to see this movie as possible.
I'd love that.
But this is a big deal. And now at this point in your career, did you feel ready? I mean, have you always felt ready to take on a role like this, or you think you needed the time?
In that moment, you're not really thinking about that. You're thinking about, damn, we just lost half our money. I know my dude that wrote this shit and my other dude, Greg Cuidar, they're hella passionate and they got their blood, sweat, and tears in this. I'm going to help them see this through. So it wasn't about, am I ready? It's like, I got a job to do. I don't have time to worry about things that don't have nothing to do with my process, so to speak, because I got to give everything I got and I need to dig somewhere deeper to even pull up some more stuff.
In 20 days, right?
In 20 days, I got there like a week and a half, 2 weeks early, just to hang out with the jockeys as much as I could. So the acclimation wasn't just me just, oh, we'll get to know one another. Like, I need to dive in like yesterday. So when you get there, you're already, and I've already done as much possible studying, going on YouTube, seeing the lifestyles, the things, the generations, how it's changed, what people loved about it. It was like baseball in the 40s. It was like they packed audiences, and it's not that today, you know?
I have to ask you one thing also in referring to Latino representation. This year marks the 10-year anniversary of Damien Bashir's nomination for A Better Life. He is one of four Latinos that have been nominated for Best Actor ever. One of two that are still alive today. Him and Edward James Olmos for Stand and Deliver. And that's Jose Ferrer, who won for Cyrano de Bergerac.
Ben Affleck, Argo.
Tony Mendez.
Oh, my bad. I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's been our little joke of Tony Mendez and Ben Affleck, who won Best Picture, but not, we know how this goes. But yeah, Jose Ferrer and Anthony Quinn, people who didn't even know he was Mexican.
Like, I know. Yeah, my grandpa was good friends with him.
Oh, yeah, they are like the same time period.
Yeah, so. He would tell me sitting outside of an audition room back in the 50s. Yeah, because he was married to Cecil B. DeMille's daughter. And there's no secret that she wasn't exactly a looker, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was kind of an ongoing joke because, you know, your father-in-law is Cecil B. DeMille. You know, so people would openly talk about it.
Really?
How ugly his wife was. Kind of sucks.
But I'm sorry. Yeah, so it was one of four people in 90, going on 94 years.
Mm.
You could be among that. It's a very small group, but...
You just say Benicio Del Toro.
Supporting actor.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, he won supporting actor for Traffic, and then... that it was funny, that season was the year that he won supporting at the Globes. He got kicked lead at SAG, and won lead at SAG, and then got back in supporting for the Oscar, and then won the Oscar.
How the hell does that happen? I can't figure shit out sometimes.
That was one of the campaign mysteries of... That's why that year no one knew who was going to win Best Actor.
Not really Mexican, he's Puerto Rican.
but we don't... Like I said, we don't have a lot here, and in 94 years, it needs to be it needs to increase, obviously, and you could be among that. What does that feel like?
I'm all for that. Let's do that. I like this conversation. I like where this is going.
Let's get an Oscar nominee. Clifton Collins Jr.
That would be amazing. Look, we're all quite humbled by the way it's been received. And when you put your heart and soul into something and people mirror that with love and admiration, and it's, you'd do a movie for no money if you knew you were going to get that reaction. Trust me.
That's awesome. Last question for you. End it out here. You were talking about the East World and, you know, all these different worlds, but you didn't talk about West World, which was interesting. So I wanted to know.
East World?
You had a quote before. You were talking about different worlds people are from. Really went to drop West World, and I was like, I'm going to see it.
I love West World.
Yeah, what's going on with it?
It's a freaking amazing show. They're shooting right now.
Are you... You get involved in it?
I've been involved. I've done some stuff.
Right.
You know, I think Westworld was just such a joy to be a part of an iconic show. You know, 1973, Yul Brynner and Brolin's dad. So to bring that back, to work with Ed Harris, the Man in Black, I mean, that's been such a fun... It's just such a fun thing across the board, and so many different, insanely talented cast. Evan, Thandi, just the entire Jeffrey Wright. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. I wore my grandfather's gun belt from Rio Bravo. Mm. Being able to gunsling, riding horse, rodeo horse, really good, well trained rodeo horses, which is quite different from the quarter horses on jockey. Like, it's two different things. One's like a trick car, and the other one's like a dragster. So, rodeo horses you can control all day long, forwards, backwards. They're like Porsches, they're just so precise. And the quarter horses, you just, you know, I hope I can nudge her a little to the left. Mm. I hope I can nudge her a little to the right. And I better not fall off.
All right. Well, cool. Also, I didn't ask this. Like, tell us about Nightmare Alley, man. What's it going to look like?
It's like a beautiful nightmarish dream come true. It is such a Nightmare Alley, visually speaking, is like this strange... dichotomy, because albeit it's nightmares, it is still just some of the stuff I've seen, I've been in such awe of the evolved camera language of Dan Lauston and Guillermo together working that collaboration, what it's brought. So it's been, we've had quite a few lengthy conversations on the interpretation of the camera movement and why it moves the way it does in certain scenes. And it was quite a mix. I worked with Guillermo on Pacific Rim. So to watch a genius, a gift to a treasure to cinema, essentially, somehow like completely elevated. I'm like, how in the hell? I understand you're going to grow, but you like exploded growed. It's like how you grew exponentially. How I was literally just trying to learn as much as I could every single day with him. He's a special dude.
Yeah,
he's magical.
Oh man, Clifton Collins Jr. Love you, man.
Thank you, brother.
I think you're too, the best. I have to let you just talk about your book real quick. You gave it to me here, and I have to. You have to plug it. Go.
Prison Ramen, all origin prison recipes. I donate 20% of the proceeds to Homeboy Industries. That's Father Greg's gig where he they work with at-risk gang youths. And it's a fantastic program. If you haven't visited, they've got the Homegirls Cafe, all organic Mexican food. You walk in that door, you just feel the love from everybody. It's a very surreal experience because I think the communities, all the different lower tier communities, the different gangs, white, black, Latino, Northsiders, Southsiders, they've been stigmatized in such these crazy ways. And to walk in and see, not just see, feel quite the opposite of that is... It really affects the heart profoundly.
That's Clifton Collins Jr., star of Sony Pictures Classics' Jockey, which hits theaters on December 29th. And that's it for this edition of the Variety Award Circuit Podcast. Drew Griffith edited this episode and Michael Schneider is the producer. Be sure to subscribe to the Award Circuit Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. Also, head to Variety.com and click on the Award Circuit tab to find the latest Oscar predictions and key races, as well as your daily fix of news, analysis, and reviews. For Jazz Tanke, Janelle Riley, and Michael Schneider, I'm Clayton Davis. We'll see you on the circuit.